Hello, and welcome to Women with Issues, the only podcast catering to America's most powerful voters. That's right, women over 50. How does that feel, ladies?
Feels good to me.
I think it feels pretty damn good. I think right now, if anyone tells you you've got some power, you should definitely get excited because there's a whole lot we don't have any power over, right?
Amen.
Yeah. I'm Diane Kilivers, and I'm here with my illustrious co-host, Tracy Maxwell Hurd, also in the most powerful voter category. Are you feeling it, Trace?
I'm feeling it.
Are you flexing? As our loyal listeners know by now, we're here to study the issues most important to our fellow power voters, women over 50, so that we can all make really informed and confident decisions when we get that ballot in November, because we're going to carry this election.
Yeah, we are.
Today, we're going to talk about the number two issue of concern. That's the economy. Oh, yes,
heavy.
I know.
Heavy.
Heavy. It's a very complex issue, especially right now, but we are really lucky because we've got a very smart and competent guest, economist Dr. Amanda Weinstein, associate professor of economics at the University of Akron in Akron, Ohio. And I know she's going to break it all down for us and give us the what on the economy. Dr. Weinstein, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited
to be here.
Let's start with the economy under President Trump. Over the last 4 years. Now, it's no secret that many of his supporters say that while they don't approve of everything he does, and they can't always defend his unscrupulous ways, there's that economy thing. So let's look at that. Over the last 4 years under Trump, several economic indicators appear to demonstrate that he has been successful at improving the economy, at least pre-coronavirus. Unemployment went down from 6% to 3.4%. GDP went up. He lowered taxes across the board for most workers. And the stock market reached an all-time high. Does that mean his voters, his base in middle America, got what they wanted from him in terms of the economy?
So I think when we look at economic numbers, and any number really, it's important to put it in context. When we think about the last 4 years, really what we are thinking about is the last time frame in terms of between June 2009 and February 2020, we had the longest economic expansion in history, 128 months. So really he is stepping into the middle of that economic expansion there. So if you look at the data, so you can go to the Federal Reserve's economic data and you can look at data on jobs and you can look at unemployment. And you can see that between that time, June 2009 through February 2020, you just see a straight line. So you see, yes, GDP increasing, you see jobs increasing, you see unemployment going down. And so our economy has gotten better over the last 4 years, but really it has gotten better over the last 128 months. Which includes the time that preceded his presidency. So really when we're thinking about kind of what was his causal impact on the economy, so there we're looking at when he came into office, do we see some kind of like we call it a structural break, right? Does something totally different happen in jobs or income? And we just kind of see, we just stayed on the same growth path we were on before. So we don't see this big causal impact, this break between before his presidency and after his presidency. We, for the most part, see we're on the same path we were on before, which is great because we were before the pandemic on a great economic path. But part of that economic path, it's not all upside, was we also saw increasing inequality and we still see a shrinking middle class. So that is still, that is part of that path before his presidency, during his presidency that we are still on, that we really haven't addressed, is how do we deal with this shrinking middle class? And so yes, our economy is doing better, but the middle class is still kind of losing out in this growth that we now see in the U.S.
Mm, wow, that's interesting.
So not quite as rosy as it appears to be. So here's my question as we have this kind of conversation. It's such a challenging and difficult conversation to have. How do we, when we're going into conversations like the economy, how do we set the table so that we're having the same conversation? You know, if you listen to one economist, you might get, you know, the picture painted from one perspective, and you listen to someone else and you get another. You know, I mean, there, I could find an economist who would credit every single thing positive that's happening right now to the president, and then find another who would say there's absolutely no nexus at all. So how do we learn as a society to set the table so that we're having the same conversation, tracking the same data, you know, with the same definitions, the same metrics, et cetera. So at the end, we can agree that we have a shared assessment of what that outcome is, good or bad. Is that possible, or is this just too big of a conversation?
I think in large part, yes. So knowing where to find that data and where to find good data. So I think as economists, we've become a little bit better at sharing the data and displaying the data. So I mentioned the Federal Reserve System. Mm-hmm. If we know we have a site to go to where they can easily throw up a visual for us so we can look at jobs, we can look at average wages, right? This becomes, for me, a great place to start from, right? So we can all start with the same data. And then I think it's important to remember when we listen to, especially economists, that economists play two roles. So one role is to understand the data and the science, you know, if we do X, what happens to jobs, unemployment. But we also often act as policy advisors. And that's a slightly different role. So as policy advisors, we're now injecting some type of value system. Mm-hmm. And so you can see economists disagree sometimes on the data and methods, but a lot of times it's just on our values. And economists aren't always that forthright in telling you, well, when I'm telling you this, this mm-hmm. is also injecting my value system that I've put on top of this data. And so that gets us, I think, a better understanding of where to come at these conversations. So we can start with the same data and then understanding where our differences in value systems come from, and also that differences in value systems are perfectly okay, and we don't mm-hmm. have to convince each other on those value systems, but more understand where those value systems are coming from to lead to those different policy prescriptions.
That's an excellent and I think really important point, because I don't think the average listener, certainly I would not necessarily be able to discern when someone is analyzing the facts or, you know, injecting a personal perspective, you know, for a policy recommendation, which, you know, is absolutely subjective. And I think that's really important, because as voters and citizens, when we're making decisions around the information we're hearing, just like with any news, you know, Diane and I are both journalists, you know, from background. If, you know, you can't editorialize and not disclose that. And that seems to be kind of a universal theme just in all news right now. But that's really a challenge here, because when we're listening to economists, we're kind of thinking, assuming we're listening to facts, and that's not necessarily all that we're getting.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, they'll be interspersed, right? So they might say the fact is unemployment is lower. That's a fact. We know from our data unemployment is lower. And then they might right after that sentence say, but it should be even lower, and how we should get there is by doing this. So usually it's not always, but I tell my students, if you hear a should, mm-hmm. there's more behind that should. Should it be lower, right? There are always trade-offs. So yes, it's unfortunate whenever anyone loses a job, but there are trade-offs there, right? And so we have trade-offs sometimes between unemployment and inflation, right? So saying a should is starting to interject a value system of what we think should happen. Should mm-hmm. unemployment be lower? And are we okay with the trade-offs associated with the policy decisions that get us to lower unemployment? And all those shoulds involve a value system that they typically don't disclose. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of trade-offs, I was wondering, is it true now, under President Trump, that he has raised the deficit, and that at some point that will have to be addressed?
Yes, that's true. So we've seen from the tax cuts he put in place along with spending increases. So you lower taxes and increase spending, that's going to increase the deficit. And he has increased the deficit similarly to, you know, the president before him. And so really what that is doing is it's, you know, increasing this deficit that at some point is going to have to be paid for. And so that might be our children who pay for that. So we are enjoying, you know, lower taxes and the spending we want on roads or whatever it is, expecting our kids to then foot the bill for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that a lot of people our age are looking at, there, you know, been rumors that he's going to pay for these tax cuts by cutting Social Security and Medicaid. or Medicare. Yeah, well, Medicaid too, I suppose. So right. I guess that's a concern. And also right now, he's going to defer payroll taxes. He's signed an executive order to defer payroll taxes. Well, and then when those taxes come due, workers are going to be getting a big bill in January or thereabouts, and, you know, have to pay that. We probably won't be through this, you know, virus issue completely by then, the pandemic. So there's another big bill, which he says he will forgive. That's a big bill for the government. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like running up your credit cards, and then, you know, eventually you're going to have to pay the piper. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. So it's exactly like running up your credit card bills. Eventually, someone's going to have to pay. We either are going to have to pay through higher taxes. Someone is going to have to do that. Or we're going to have to pay through lower spending. And as you mentioned, that lower spending could be on things like Social Security. And when we often talk about cuts to Social Security, we often talk about them without talking about how this actually impacts people. And this is especially important for women over 50, because women are more likely to rely on Social Security than men. Right. So we say as if it's a gender neutral policy. We're going to cut Social Security. It is absolutely not a gender neutral policy. This affects women far more than it does men. Why? It actually comes back to the choices and the things that women face even back in their 20s. So the gender wage gap. The gender wage gap 20 years ago was higher than it was today. And you faced what we think was more discrimination based on gender 20 years ago. But what that also means is that women in their 50s today are on an entirely different economic trajectory than their male counterparts simply because of their gender, which then makes them rely on things like Social Security more than men through no fault of their own. This could also be women who, when they were in their 20s, took a year or two off to raise their kids. Mm-hmm. The workforce will punish them for that, and that sets them on a different trajectory.
Or 20, like me. Wow.
So that kind of segues into what we really want to focus on with this whole economy thing, that is how women are impacted differently. You know, we know that there's been the conversation, just as you alluded to, around, you know, women stepping out of the workforce, you know, for a number of years to raise children, the wage gap, which still continues to be true or to exist. What are some other economic factors that cause us to perform at a lower level than our male counterparts? Just generally going through life.
So there's a lot of things. So, and actually related to the pandemic as well. So women tend to choose care occupations. So occupations that are related to education or healthcare. Mm-hmm. Now, before this pandemic, they were rewarded in part for choosing those care occupations because those care occupations were growing. Okay. But suddenly with the pandemic, what you get is those care occupations are also those people occupations where you're interacting with people, and people is how this virus is spread. Mm-hmm. And so the very occupations that were growing, right? So women were kind of making the right choices, choosing to go into these growing career fields, are now the fields that got cut almost instantly with this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so this put more of this burden on our economy, on women during this pandemic, and really punished them for making the right decisions before the pandemic, which is unlike previous recessions.
Okay.
So in the Great Recession, it hit men really hard. And so it was kind of dubbed the man session. Okay. This one is not like that, because it's really punishing women for doing these jobs where you interact with people. And they're the jobs that actually are increasingly important in our economy. But it's punishing women for making the very right choices in our economy.
Right. Wow. So how do we advise them? You know, going forward, we know that COVID has impacted just our overall society so negatively. And, you know, the economy is what you hear about every day. It's COVID, and then it's COVID as it impacts the economy. So going forward, for women and just for, you know, society in general, how do we work our way out? But I mean, first to women, because I really like the point that you made about the career paths that we were choosing and how we were really smart and intentional about making those choices. And now that in light of this pandemic has backfired on us. So how does that play out long-term for women? How do we recover from that?
So the hope right now is that the losses we've gotten in those people-based jobs are short-lived. And so we don't know that that's true, but we kind of hope that these are short-lived. And as we recover from this pandemic and this recession, that those jobs will return is the hope. Mm-hmm. So our worry is that some of it might not be short-lived. We might figure out a way to kind of do without some of these jobs. But I think an even larger worry is not only with these type of occupations, but with all occupations and all industries women are in, we're now facing a childcare crisis. And so you go back to women having to make the decisions that they had to make 20 and 30 years ago to stop working so that they can take care of their kids or take care of their grandkids or taking care of an elderly parent. And when women have to step back from their career and take a break from their career or just put more attention on children or loved ones, whatever that they're having to put this attention onto, it again puts them on this different trajectory. Mm-hmm. And it's putting this burden more on women, which also affects their careers. It also affects our businesses, our economies. It affects everything. So this is really an issue that women were facing before the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? We don't have universal pre-K. We don't right. have universal childcare, exactly. which means this burden still, and I want to give credit to the men. So men have stepped up and are spending more time with children now than they did before. So I don't want to not give them their credit. However, even breadwinning women still tend to spend more time than their husbands with their children, mm-hmm. right? And so this is really an issue. And part of the issue is society and families and households having these conversations of making sure this childcare is more evenly spread. But also it's a conversation for how do we really address childcare? Right. Where childcare more than ever we're seeing is really, you know, it's no different than a road in terms of I need this to work, mm-hmm. right? I need a road to get to my job, but I also need childcare to get to my job. Right. And so we need to really address childcare, which affects not only mothers, but if you have for me, it also affects my mother because my mother watches my children, sure. right? So this affects a lot. It tends to be more women, not all women, some men. But we really need to address childcare as this kind of infrastructure for families. Yeah, and that is something now, before now, increasingly now, after the pandemic, we need to address.
Well, there is somebody who's addressing it. I saw the other day that Biden's plan, he rolled out a plan, $775 billion to help working parents and caregivers. It's care for small children and older adults. Higher pay for caregivers is on the agenda. An $8,000 child care tax credit is framed as an economic imperative. Mm-hmm. And this he's saying, will change a family's finances. He also wants paid family leave. And he's announced proposals to eliminate the waiting list for home and community care under Medicaid. And then he wants to do a bailout for child care centers, many of which I've been hearing are going out of business due right. to this pandemic. Yeah. He also is promoting a national pre-K for all children aged 3 to 4. In our group of women over 50, I'm not in this boat, but I've spoken to a lot of women who are providing the child care, like your mother, Dr. Weinstein. Yeah, so they're burdened as well, especially if they also work, mm-hmm. Maybe there are women in our age group who I'm sure have, foregone work or decided to quit their jobs in order to help their children and, by babysitting grandchildren. Yeah, it also affects their income. So it is a big, big issue.
Yeah, it's interesting the things that come up tangential to, these larger subjects that really it takes a crisis to kind of bring it to the forefront. Because Dr. Weinstein, as you had mentioned, early childhood development, pre-K, paid or supplemented daycare, these are not new topics. They've been around forever. But I think the pandemic is really just bringing to focus, as in so many other areas, the necessity to really address and solve this now. Because when we hit crises economically, these things just kind of exacerbate that crisis. And also looking at what our social constructs have been. Historically, women stay at home. We are the caregivers. We're the nurturers. We weren't expected to work at one point in time. And it was all about, the man bringing home the bacon and all of that. But now, just seeing how women have performed in the economy or in the workforce and where we're adding value and how the fact that we're there is really multiplying the economy. I mean, it's a good thing to have, you know, we're more people, and that's more people doing work, more people making money, more people putting money back into the economy. So do you think that that will start to change just some of those underlying social determinants and how we look at things and how we look at women in the workforce?
I think so. I think today's generation, we look at them, you know, very differently. It's now the norm to have dual earner households. Mm-hmm. That did not used to be the norm. Right. So that is a huge shift. And I don't think policymakers have quite caught up to that shift of understanding that when you're talking to households, most households are dual earner households. You have two workers in that household. They still have the children. Right. And having women in our economy is incredibly important. It's also incredibly important to have them at home, but we know they do incredible things for our economy. So one study I did found that for every 10% increase in the labor force participation of women, mm-hmm. increased average wages by 5%, and that's for men and women.
Okay.
And so you see those benefits are for our economy. Men benefit from having the ideas and innovations that women have in these workforce, right. But it also relies on this underlying idea that those children are taken care of, mm-hmm. and taken care of well, right? We, all mothers, all fathers, we want our children to be in a place where they are growing and happy, quality daycare, quality K-12 education. Us going to work and being comfortable going to work relies on that. Right. So what that also means is childcare is also an economic development policy, right? So if I have good childcare, I'm more likely to go to work. More women going to work means higher wages, not just for women, higher wages for everybody. Exactly. And as you mentioned, this is not new, right? So if we compare the U.S. to other countries, I think we don't realize other countries do this. And the OECD, we are kind of the exception for not doing this. And so we are falling behind in terms of our enrollment rates for pre-K education. Mm-hmm. So for our economy right now, right, that means probably fewer women working than maybe is optimal. But if you think about what that impact is for our economy in 20 years, and our policymakers don't often have this 20-year look at the economy, right?
Sure.
But we know early childhood education increases the likelihood you go to college. It increases educational attainment. It increases the likelihood you have a job. You're less likely to be unemployed, right? Starting really with early childhood education.
Absolutely.
It's an economic development strategy, but it's a long run. You know, so you're waiting 20 years to get that result. But even in the U.S., if we really know women's importance, we get those early childhood education policies. And we had them in World War II. When suddenly we needed Rosie the Riveter,
right?
It became real easy, and we had a federal policy, everybody gets daycare. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was really easy when it became very clear how much we need women in the workforce.
Right.
And I think, I hope now we're realizing we still really need women in the workforce, slightly different, right? So we're not, you know, building airplanes, but we're in those hospitals, right? We're taking care of this pandemic. We're the ones more likely to be in those hospitals, have those nursing positions, you know, doing the testing to deal with this pandemic and to deal with healthcare.
Right. And when you look at the increasing cost of living, it's become more of a requirement for dual income households now. Because, you know, whereas back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, a one income household was sufficient to have a car, buy a home, put the kids through college and all of that. And those numbers don't add up the same way anymore. So to have that same quality of life and give that same expectation to children, it does now require, you know, a dual income household, you know, unless one of you is doing exceptionally well. But when you're just looking at the norm, that it takes two people, and looking at us being competitive as a country. I love the point that you made about that, around how early childhood education impacts long-term our competitiveness as a country with other countries. It impacts our, you know, our economic prosperity again, and our competitiveness with other countries. So yeah, when you lay out, you know, all of the factors there, hopefully, you know, we'll become more cognizant from a policy perspective and put more energy in that direction.
I hope so. We'll see.
Changing the subject just a little bit, looking at the stock market, we've had a pretty chaotic stock market run under President Trump. Mm-hmm. It's been up and down a whole lot. It did hit an all-time high, you know, way down when the pandemic started. And now somehow way up. I know that for the large majority of Americans, they're not heavily invested in the stock market. So do those numbers mean anything to them? Is it not inclusive of them? Because does it mean that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer and the middle class is still shrinking? Because I know that 50% of workers in the U.S. work for small businesses that are not represented in the stock market. So explain that disconnect there between the unemployment rate, which is came out at 8.4% in August, but yet we've got this crazy high stock market.
Yeah, so the question the stock market really asks is like, how are these big corporations doing? So if that's the question you're asking, that's the stock market can kind of give you that answer. Here's how big companies are doing. And it turns out a lot of big companies are actually doing okay right now. If you think, I think of Amazon, right? Amazon's doing okay right now.
Right.
That's reflected in the stock market. If you think about Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Amazon, right? They're 20% of the NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. Large companies, and they're doing okay. And so really that's the stock market saying, hey, those big companies are doing fine. But you hit the nail on the head. What about the small businesses? Mm-hmm. We know right now small businesses are not fine. They are really struggling right now. They are disproportionately facing the impact of coronavirus and of this recession. And the stock market does not reflect how small businesses are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. And, you have a good share of Americans don't own stocks.
Right.
So large companies doing well doesn't help their investment portfolio.
And exactly. If they not do everyone. Own stocks, they don't own the FANG stocks of Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And also, of course, those companies are doing great through the pandemic because what are we all doing at home? We're on Facebook. We're using our Apple devices. We're watching Netflix. That's we're it. On Google,
Sure. So you got it.
To come and to our house, yeah.
Yeah, and those companies have not invested the huge profits they've made, back into the economy to help get us out of this pandemic either.
So how do we have that holistic conversation? What, you started out your response by saying, if the question you're asking is, so how do we as society have a common conversation, kind of going back to what I was saying before, because there's so many things that are put before us to interpret or to consume as facts around what represents a productive economy, like the stock market that Diane just brought up. So what are the questions that we should be asking as consumers, as citizens, to really get an accurate perspective on the performance of the economy?
Right. So I think the first thing would be there's never going to be one metric. So like the stock market, that one metric is never going to cover the economy and really no metric can do it. So we want to kind of get touch points on a lot of different, right? So looking at jobs, looking at unemployment, looking at average wages, looking at kind of inflation adjusted wages in terms of our purchasing power, right? So our wage might go up, but if inflation goes up, how much does that mean to us? Mm-hmm. So kind of starting to take all of those aspects in, but then also asking kind of more complicated questions, not just are we kind of bigger, more jobs, higher wages, but also what does that growth look like? And so now you're getting at a little bit of kind of inequality issues, right? So if when we are growing, if GDP is getting bigger, but the benefits of that growth only go to a slice of, the American population, then even talking about growth might not be an impactful measure for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
When the growth is growing only to a small percentage of the population, just like when there's growth in stocks, that growth doesn't go to everybody, right? And so then you're talking about a discussion of not only growth, jobs, unemployment, but then also how it's distributed. Mm-hmm. But even within that conversation of inequality, right? So even that alone, you're thinking, all right, how much is inequality affecting me or people I know or even people I don't know? And so for a lot of Americans, it's not exactly the inequality, but it's more the mobility. And the two are related, right? So the less mobile our society is, right, you have inequality from that. If we have, higher inequality, but more mobility, right? So a lot of Americans tend to be okay with that. And so then even talking about how we're growing is not just about the distribution, it's also about the mobility, right? Can someone, anyone who wants to grow up, go get a good education, work hard, and be successful? Can they climb that income ladder?
Okay.
Right, which I think is more of an important question, but it also relates to growth, because the more people that can climb that income ladder, the more growth you have, and the more well-being, and the more shared well-being. And so it kind of addresses all of it all at the same time.
Sure. I think that's a great, that leads me to think about the thing that that always frustrates me, and that's the whole concept of the trickle-down economics and the fact that, first of all, it doesn't trickle down. It doesn't, hasn't. That's not how it functions. You know, you were talking about that small slice of the pie that gets, that benefits from that conversation around growth and the stock market. But the question you said about how does it affect me, that's the question that I think is really the important one, because even though it doesn't directly affect you or immediately affect you, I don't think we can live in society and not be affected by all of it ultimately, because even if we're talking about that 1% who's benefiting from a high-performing stock market, well, if the middle class is shrinking and the poor are getting poorer, ultimately, is that not going to affect that 1% or 10%, whatever, because we're their consumers. We're their, you know, we're the ones that are making them the 1%. So it does, I don't believe it trickles down, but I believe it does all come around eventually. Is that correct?
That's correct. So I think this pandemic, for me, when I've been kind of tracking how this is played out in our economies, if you are looking at this data, I think it really highlights the point that you just made, right? So we look at the impact of the recession right now in terms of jobs lost and in terms of higher unemployment. But if you look at when this pandemic hit, and we often say like, oh, well, there were shutdowns. Yes, there were shutdowns. Mm-hmm. But if you look at when consumers stopped spending, right? Mm-hmm. This is when we were worried about the pandemic.
Right.
We stopped spending before the shutdowns happened.
Right.
Right. So then you can think about why were those jobs lost? Mm-hmm. Those jobs were lost because I stopped going to restaurants and I stopped going to concerts and we all stopped doing those things. And in large part, we still are not doing the things we usually would with the restaurants, concerts, you know, leisure and recreation type stuff.
Right.
Where do you see the job impacts the most? In restaurants, leisure activities, recreation, where we stop spending that money.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about that impact, right, what is the impact on the economy? This is all us.
Right.
This is all where we are choosing to spend our money or not choosing to spend our money. And I think the interesting thing with that is there are some estimates that women make 80% of household consumption decisions.
Right. Exactly.
So if you want to know, yeah. So if you want to know how the pandemic is affecting the recession, you better go ask women.
Mm-hmm.
How are you spending your money? I'm not spending my money going out as much and going to restaurants. I am spending my money on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
right? And so again, even that we often talk about is like, oh, Amazon's doing well just because mm-hmm. Amazon does well, you know, Jeff Bezos, whatever.
We're not buying new clothes because we have nowhere to go.
Right. Buy jeans. I mean, I'm only going to wear leggings.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, right. I think the athleisure industry, you know, that, you know, they got a huge benefit from the pandemic. Right.
Yes. And we often think about, well, the CEO just did a great job. Mm-hmm. CEOs need to do a great job, but I'm sorry, they're doing well because I want to wear their product, right? Is how I spend my money. Mm-hmm. And so if you really want a touch point on the economy, and I think this is something policymakers still don't quite understand, the media still doesn't quite understand. If you want to know why Amazon's doing well, if you want to know why restaurants aren't doing well, go talk to women, because
right.
they're in large part the ones deciding how to spend their money. And when they stop spending their money or start spending their money, that's where you see the jobs or don't see the jobs. So you got to know what women want. And
absolutely.
It turns out sometimes male policymakers don't know that.
But I think they're getting it a little more and more. I mean, you're seeing that more in marketing. You're seeing them, even when it comes to things like buying cars and different decisions that have been made around how cars are designed. And my husband's a huge car guy, so I've learned tons about, more than I ever thought I would. But I mean, little things around how the knobs are placed and function, because women have fingernails. Just, you know, the ergonomics
right.
of how, you know, cars are designed, especially when you're talking about things like minivans and things, you know,
oh, yeah.
that transport families and things. So they're taking us into consideration a little more, the whole power base again of who we are and our ability and opportunity to impact, whether we're talking about, you know, the power of our dollars or the power of our votes. You know, and often they go hand in hand. We demonstrate our satisfaction or dissatisfaction with how we spend our dollars and how we're voting at the polls, especially around the economy.
speaking of cars, you know, I always, you know, I said to my husband the other day, I said, you can tell, you know, a woman didn't design this car. And he said, why do you say that? You know, my husband's an investment advisor. And I said, there's nowhere to put your purse.
Yeah.
There's no room here. And seriously, you know, if you have, if you're driving and you have a passenger, you know, you got to put it in the back seat. You can't reach anything. Mm-hmm. Little things like, we go to a restaurant. I said, a man did not design those women's bathrooms. And he says, how do you know? And I go, there's no hook for my purse on the back of the stall door.
And the door's still open the wrong way.
I know. I say that all the time. So I think you're right. I think we have recently, the marketing people, so I have a lot of marketing colleagues, they have got this down. They know that it's about women. I don't think everyone outside of marketing has figured it out, but and I do think the car companies are coming around, but they had a serious reckoning less than a decade ago when it came out that they had no test dummies that were shaped like women. God. They were all shaped like men's bodies. Right. Nowhere in any executive's mind in the entire car industry did they say, you know what, on safety, we should see how a woman's body is impacted in a car crash. Yeah. No one thought to do that. And was she like, well, you know, who cares if like, a, you know, a dummy has like a wig on or something, right? No, it's not about the wig, right?
No. Exactly.
But women are more likely to die in the same exact car crash than men. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is our lives.
Absolutely.
Right? They have totally put our lives at risk. And if you think about even the design of, you know, I totally point out all the design that just, I'm like, that was not designed by man. They should have had a woman standing there. But even like the airbag, right? Why does it matter that women's bodies are smaller, that we're shorter, right? So if you design an airbag for a man, where does it hit, right? It hits his chest, which is where it's supposed to be.
Your face, right.
Yeah. Now imagine a woman who's shorter and smaller. Where does it hit her? It hits her in her chin and pushes her head back.
Exactly.
That's an issue. That's a big issue. And that's just on safety, let alone like, hey, I want my kids to be able to get in this car without having them take 15 minutes because they want to do it by themselves and climb up this massive SUV by themselves. Right. I've got a minivan so that they can just get right in there themselves. Right.
Yeah. All of those issues are hugely important. But what advice do you have for those who are running for office now, for our listeners, in terms of what considerations should they be making around the economy right now? What things should they be looking for? What factors should they be considering when they're getting ready to go to the polls around this huge, confusing subject of the economy?
I think for policymakers and for everybody, I kind of think about this as just, we need to think about it in more of a messy way. Okay. I feel like women are comfortable with mess, right? Yeah. We've had this messy life with kids and work, and like, we're kind of okay with a little chaos and mess, right? Sure. And I feel like maybe some of the men are, you know, not as used to the mess and chaos. Like, I just go to my job and I come back. It's very clean, right?
Agreed.
But our economy is messy. Our lives are messy. Our cities are messy, right? And they're messy because there isn't a delineation between the two, really. If our families aren't doing well, our economy's not doing well, right? And so they're all interacting. So you can't talk about childcare as if it doesn't affect our economy. You can't talk about healthcare as if it doesn't affect our economy, right? And you can't talk about, you know, healthcare as if the economy doesn't affect it, right? We know unemployment affects, you know, healthcare issues, right? There are no lanes. It's all messy, right? And so we need everyone to be a little, you know, more okay with the messiness, and policymakers to be okay with the messiness. So listen to that messiness. I need childcare and I need to be able to get to work, right? So we need to talk about how do we deal with all of those things so we can kind of live our best life and all that we want to do, whatever it is we want to do, work, childcare, recreation, right? What are the policies that kind of address aspects of those or all of them, thinking about all these things at the same time? So there's not just one, like, I want to increase employment. There's no one measure I want to increase employment, because it's not just increasing employment. There's always trade-offs and other dependencies you're thinking about. So you have to think about how does this one policy affect, you know, childcare or healthcare, or all the other things.
Excellent.
With our audience, women over 52, they're concerned about age discrimination in the workplace. They're concerned about the, you know, long-term financial security with, you know, Medicaid and Medicare. They want to elect officials, and particularly the president, that they can trust when they say, yes, Medicare will be there for you. Yes, you know, Social Security will be there for you. They want to be able to trust that. and trust and ethics, that is the third top concern for women in our age group.
Yeah, that's important. And that's something the pandemic, I think, is not talked about very much, is that some people were forced to retire early, right? They didn't want to retire this year. They were forced to retire this year. And that's very different, being forced to retire this year than choosing to retire this year, or even being laid off. And when you talk about age discrimination, so if there are women out there saying, you know what, or I was laid off, or I'm going to take this year off and then I'll get back to work, you know, after the pandemic, you absolutely face age discrimination in hiring, right? So the employer, you know, is going for someone who's younger. And so then they don't face the same decisions in recovery that younger workers do. They're going to be less likely to be hired back. So this pandemic is more likely to have a longer term effect on older workers than it does younger workers.
Right.
And I think, you know, on the Democratic side, now you've got a woman who is one of us, Kamala Harris, a woman over 50. Right. I, you know, wonder if she will be a champion for us.
Hopefully. I know a lot of women are looking for her to be a champion for women just across the board. And I think it's going to definitely have an impact on this whole economic conversation, just having a woman at that level at the table all the time and in the room. And just as we've seen today in our conversation with Dr. Weinstein, the perspective matters and certainly impacts the outcome.
Absolutely. Representation matters. So yes, it's important for, you know, policymakers to listen to women, but just having a someone there that represents us is a huge difference maker, right? We know that they know things about childcare. It's like ingrained, or they know that, like, I might have to take care of my elderly parent. It's right. More ingrained, and you don't even have to explain as much. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to worry as much about their listening because they know your circumstances and the policies, right? Mm-hmm. And even with women, right, it's the messiness, right? They're okay with thinking about that messiness like in policy, right? It's not just this policy affects this and nothing else. Mm-hmm. Nah, there's messiness there. That mm-hmm. policy can have other unintended consequences, and we also need to think about these other aspects. And even that is a bonus when we think about policy now.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's men, I think, are more linear, you know, in their thinking. And we tend to manage, we're forced into multitasking because we are operating in all of the arenas with our children, our husband, our parents, our jobs, our homes and families. So yeah, we definitely are operating in the mess all of the time, and more adept at managing it, I think. I think that's an excellent point.
I want to bring up too, just because I think we left out in under the caregivers category. Caregivers also, I think about my dad when he had Alzheimer's disease, and my mom, he went to adult daycare just to give my mom a break. So money spent on caregivers also includes that, because there are a lot of women over 50, 60, 70, 80 who need that kind of care, adult daycare, or right. spouse, or a parent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Weinstein, you have been absolutely fantastic. We could go on and on with questions about this, and it is so exciting to be able to approach a subject that's this complicated and this confusing for most of us, and to really be able to engage in a conversation with someone who's so adept but can translate as well. So that's been hugely helpful to us in the conversation today. I know our listeners appreciate it. I hope that we will have another opportunity to have you back again. This conversation nor the podcast are going to go away after the election. We've just been trying to get people focused and ready for that. But women with issues, you know, there will be women, and we're going to continue to have issues. So that's going to go forward beyond this.
November.
Absolutely. And we would love to engage you in a conversation about what this looks like and what we should be teeing up for, especially post-pandemic, because we're going to be hopeful and optimistic that that post-era is on the horizon here. So thank you so much for your time and your input today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've gotten clear on some things. I'm excited. I still have a lot of other questions, though. I'll get ready for next time.
So, thank you, Tracy and Diane. This was a lot of fun. I love talking about all these issues.
That's great. Yeah.
So we are Women With Issues again. We can be found on Facebook at facebook.womenwithissuespodcast.com. And we are also on Instagram and Twitter as Women With Issues. We want to thank our technical producer, Cade Hessman.
Cade.
You the man. And again, thanks to our guest, Dr. Amanda Weinstein.
We are Women with Issues. Thanks so much for joining us. We're talking to you. See you next time.
Bye-bye.